Fun Ideas Productions presents the Fun Ideas Podcast.
If you're unhappy most of the time, and you're indoors when the sun begins to shine, you're barred down with responsibility. When the good sun shines, you can come out with.
Hi, this is Mark Arnold, and welcome to Fun Ideas Podcast number 258. I will be at the Mid-Valley Comic Art Expo in Salem, Oregon on April 20th and 21st, and Shortbox Live in San Jose, California on May 5th, signing copies of my new Turtles book and new Mad books. How do you do? The purpose of this recording is to introduce you to my new book set called Unconditionally Mad, Part 1 and Part B. First, allow me to introduce myself. My name is Mark D. Arnold, and I am the writer of Unconditionally Mad. It's my job. My name is Mark D. Arnold, and I am the writer of Unconditionally Mad. It's my job to... I am the writer of Unconditionally Mad, and it's my job... What's so funny about that? Well, anyway, here's William M. Gaines, Harvey Kurtzman, Jack Davis, Wally Wood, Bill Elder, Al Feldstein, Norman Mingo, Kelly Fries, Bob Clark, Frank Jacobs, Don Martin, Don Edwing, Paul Coker, Nick Meglin, Dave Berg, George Woodbridge, Mort Drucker, Al Jaffe, Dick DeBartolo, Sergio Aragonés, Angelo Torres, Tom Bunk, John Ficarra, Tom Richmond, Desmond Devlin, Sam Viviano, Johnny Sampson, Bill Morrison, Susie Splab, and many more. And here's the publisher, Bear Manor Media. Available now through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Bear Manor Media. The Fun Ideas Podcast is brought to you in part by Freaky Magazine. I contribute material to every issue, so give it a try.
Hey, kids. Have you read Freaky? The magazine of weird humor for freaks like you. Freaky Magazine is a way-out collection of weirdo comics, kooky gags, photo funnies, social satire, and surreal collage. 52 pages of insanity in the tradition of magazines of yore like Cracked, Plop, and Zap. Special offer for Fun Ideas listeners, get a free sample copy in the mail, made of smelly newsprint and smudgy ink the old-fashioned way. Just message your mailing address to theslowpoisoner@gmail.com. That's theslowpoisoner@gmail.com while supplies last.
Friends, have you tried Lee's Comics? Lee's Comics is better than the leading comic book store. Wait a minute. Lee's Comics is the leading comic book store, based on arbitrary standards set by Lee Hester himself.
Lee's Comics was named as one of the 21 best online dealers by PopOptique.com. To shop the Lee's Comics eBay store, go to eBay and search for Lee's Comics, Inc. That's LEESCOMICSINC, period. Don't forget the period. Mention the Fun Ideas Podcast when you order, and you'll receive a free bonus gift.
Hey, hey, it's Charles Rosenay from the Monkees Interview Show here on Monkey Mania Radio. So proud to announce the release of a brand new book called Not Just Happy Together, The Turtles from A to Z. That's right, the other band besides our monkeys who should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, The Turtles, a great new book that's a discography. It's got interviews, it's got reviews, it's got everything you might want to read about. if you're a 60s fan like I am and love the Beatles and the Monkees and the Turtles. Not just Happy Together has a front cover and a back cover by Henry Diltz, a foreword by Gary Puckett, and it's published by Genius Music Books, an imprint of Genius Book Publishing, now available from www.notjusthappytogether.com. Hope you pick it up. I know you're going to love it and enjoy all the stuff about the Turtles. Thank you for listening to Monkey Mania Radio. Hey, hey.
In Fun Ideas Productions news, Unconditionally Mad Part 1 and Part B are out, as is Not Just Happy Together, The Turtles from A to Z, AM Radio to Zappa. Currently, I'm working on TV Cartoons That Time Forgot, and a new book called The Magazine That Dared to Be Dumb, The History of Crazy Magazine. All of my books are available through Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and most are available through Bear Manor Media. The Turtles book is through Genius Publishing. On today's show, we have an author who has written numerous books about various classic game shows, including Password, The Match Game, and his latest book on The Gong Show. Here he is, Adam Neediff.
Hi, this is Mark Arnold with another episode of Fun Ideas Podcast. And today I have an author who's written a number of books about game shows, among other things. And his name is Adam Neediff. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm looking forward to this.
All right. I've actually seen you before briefly on Stu's show. I know you've been on there before with Stu's show stack. And I've known about your books, but I've never actually talked to you or met you or anything, but the encouraging thing is I always say you've written all the books I wanted to write, but I didn't I wanted to read but didn't want to write. There we go.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the opportunity to plug this one, because Stu will have nothing to do with this book, so you're filling in a void.
The Gong Show. Typical of him. Oh, I hate that show, you know. It's like, no, come on, it was great anyway. I fill in the gaps. Before we continue, I'm seeing your stuff in your background. You said it's just all your toys and everything.
Oh, yeah.
All the password games. I'm saying, is that all of them? All the versions?
That is, you are literally correct. That is all of the password games. Every password game that's ever been published, I have them. Including, this is my favorite, they released a version called the Collector's Edition, and it comes in a leather case with a wood grain finish on it.
Fancy.
So it's kind of like bringing out the good silverware for company. Whenever I have people over, we play the good password game.
Okay. Because I'm looking at it, it's like, I assume all those different versions that have different clues, they're not just the same game each time.
They're all different words, and it's kind of funny. When Milton Bradley reached the 23rd, 24th, 25th edition, thereabouts, you can tell that they had kind of exhausted the universe of usable material for password, because the passwords in the higher numbered editions are words like bedraggled and cached.
At that point, they're getting the Oxford Dictionary.
Yeah.
Oh, here's a word, anti-disestablishmentarianism. Okay. Anyway. All right. So I just had to say that. And you did write a book, at least The Life and Wife of Alan Ludden. So I know it applies to that. And
very proud of that one. When Betty White passed away, her assistant posted the last photo ever taken of Betty, and Betty had that book on her coffee table. So
that's cool.
That was a nice little trophy for me. I really take a lot of pride in that.
All right. That's really cool. I'm going to ask you about this first. Well, first of all, tell me how you got interested in game shows and into writing and everything, and then we'll leap into what I think is your first series of books.
I got into game shows because I was always obsessed with them as a kid. I think it has a lot to do with the sensory appeal, with the colors and the sounds and the lights and the things that spin around. There's a lot of things about a game show that reach out and grab a kid, especially the game shows of the 80s, which really had that stuff in droves. So game shows just always appealed to me from the very, very beginning. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to work in that world when I grew up, and I had a chance to come out here in 2007.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where's here?
Los Angeles.
You are in LA. Sorry, I should have asked.
And I found that getting into game shows wasn't the easiest thing in the world. It's an insulated community, and a lot of it is networking based, as is much of show business, as much of the entertainment business. People hire who they know, and nobody knew me. So I needed to do something to get my name out there. So I started writing books about the history of game shows. I got my 15 minutes of fame in a segment on Conan where I was his tour guide when he visited Madame Tussauds. And it was a little 5-minute segment, and I borrowed off the fame from that just enough to get a book deal and start writing books about the history of game shows. And happily, eventually those books began falling into the laps of the people who did work in the game show business and were in a position to hire people. And I finally started getting some breaks, and I've been in game shows pretty much full time for the past 8 years.
Doing what exactly?
I've done a couple of jobs. I've written questions for some shows. I've designed visual puzzles for Idiot Test. But the thing that I'm hired for most often is question research. And the elegantly simple way to explain what question research is when you're watching a game show and a contestant gives a dodgy answer and the host says, I need to check with the judges on this. That's me. I'm judges.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm the guy in charge of making sure that the correct answer is actually the correct answer. And if they say something that's not exactly what we had in mind, I am the guy who is in charge of researching the questions in advance and seeing, is this question written in such a way that anything else can be taken as a correct answer, and making a note of it ahead of time.
And of course, I see that the most on Jeopardy. So do you work on Jeopardy or?
No, I've not had a chance to work on Jeopardy. They have an extraordinary group of people on Jeopardy. I've worked mostly for Game Show Network these last few years.
Okay.
On many of their shows, and done a few things for Nickelodeon.
Got it. Okay. But yeah, I'm well versed in that. It's like somebody will say, you know, using Jeopardy again as an example, what is big? No, we were looking for large. And it's like,
yeah,
come on, you know. It's like, anyway. But you know, then they adjust the score and they find out it was correct. You have $80,000. Yeah. So anyway, so.
And I mean, you know, it's an interesting roller coaster of emotions for that job, because I've done both sides of that. I've worked on a show where we had to take $10,000 away from somebody. Right. And I've worked on a show where we had to change our minds and say, hey, they actually do deserve the $10,000. So we've had reversals of fortune both ways. Right. And it's a wild thing to go through. Yeah.
So which book was your first out of all?
My first book, the first one that came out was Quizmaster, which is my biography of Bill Cullen. I'm currently working on a revised version of that.
Okay.
Because Bill left behind such a body of work that 10 years after Quizmaster was published, we're still finding things about him. We're still finding. Like, for example, a few years ago, a collector reached out to me and said, I have some audio here, and I think it's Bill Cullen, if you listen to the voice. And it's Bill Cullen reporting on Franklin Roosevelt's death. It's the CBS, basically the network's 11 o'clock news on the radio network. And it's Bill Cullen leading off by announcing that FDR is dead. And now here's our anchor, or here's whatever the term they used, because it wouldn't have been anchor yet. But here's John Charles Daly with the news. So, yeah, that's an interesting chunk of history. So we've got Bill announcing that Franklin Roosevelt is dead. And we've also got audio of Bill explaining how you can make projects at home using a simple laser printer. That's how long his career spanned. It's just,
wow.
There's just so much to dig into. And it turns out we're not finished finding all the stuff he did.
Now, is the original version still in print? Because I pulled...
Yeah, it's still out. If you want to take a look, it's available at bearmannermedia.com, the
publisher,
or on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. But
I pulled this
Consumer Advisory.
Yeah,
Consumer Advisory, and I'm the first one to say it as the author. Be mindful of the fact there is another edition of that Bill Cullen book coming.
Right.
So,
well, I knew something was up because I pulled, you know, a list of your books. And on Amazon right now, it shows it at $93 for the paperback. So I was wondering, did that go out of print?
That's the copy that was autographed by Bill Cullen.
Oh, okay. I mean, and then it does say normally it's like about $32, which is, you know, about average for these type of books. So I get it, you know, but it's like, I go, whoa.
No, the algorithm got really, really messed up one day. And there was a paperback copy going for about $1,200.
Oh, geez.
I still don't understand. First of all, if you're listening to this and you're the person that bought that $1,200 copy, I'm sorry, but also I want to meet you.
Yes. I'm the wealthiest person on earth. I don't care. You know? For some reason, I thought, and then now I remember, and you did say that on Stu's show, that Quizmaster was your first book. So you did say that. But the ones that are kind of piquing my interest of looking at all these, and you've talked about them on that show too, is This Day in Game Show History. And there's a number of these. So
Four volumes, and I never intended for it to be a four-volume set, but it turned into a mammoth by the time I was writing it, because it's 365 essays about game show history.
Okay.
Are you familiar at all with something called Uncle John's Bathroom Reader?
Yes.
Okay.
John Jovna. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to write a book like that with game show history stuff.
Oh, okay.
And just to give me some sense of focus, just so I wouldn't go all over the place with writing these essays about game show history, I decided to go with game show milestones for every day of the year, just so I'd have something to work with when I was figuring out what to write for each day of the year. But yeah, that's basically what I had in mind, was a bathroom book for game show fans. And it turned into a four-volume set, 365 essays about the history of game shows. And between that and Quizmaster, I was able to establish that resume and just keep building and building and building and building a name. And beyond that, not only am I now working in the game show business, but what's happened is there's still demand for the books, which is why I've kept writing them. And it's now expanded into a museum project, the Sprong National Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. Mm-hmm. I am involved with them in the development of the National Archives of Game Show History. It is a museum wing that will be dedicated to the history of game shows. And we're hoping to open that in the next few years. And I'm thrilled with the work that we've been able to do so far with assembling oral histories from people who are involved in the game show business and collecting props, set pieces, and behind-the-scenes paraphernalia from the world of game shows.
Mm-hmm. Now, on all these books on the game show day in history, was it hard to find enough items? I mean, I guess you could make up any.
It was a challenge, but it ended up working out. I was game for it, and I was happy that I was able to do it. And it took a lot of discipline, but the thing that I was really proud of was I managed to do that book in 1 year. I committed myself to writing an essay a day. And sometimes I had to write an essay after I'd gotten home from work after a double shift, but I managed to write an essay every day for 1 year. And if I had a sick day or a day off from work, I would take full advantage of that and write multiple essays. So that gave me a chance to rest up on some days, at least.
Yes, yes.
but yeah, that book took me 1 year to write, and they split it into four books, and people bought them. And I can't say thank you enough to the people that bought all four copies.
Oh, I see. So you wrote the whole mammoth four thing as one book originally.
Yeah.
Oh, I get it. Okay. I was thinking you wrote four of them, and it's like after the third
I'm running out of things here. Yeah, I wrote one, but I mean, it just, there was no way it could fit into one. So
I get it. Yeah. I've had a couple of my books split. So I get it. You know. In saying that, one of your books also is Game Show FAQ or FAQ or whatever you want to call it. Is some of the material repeated in that from the other?
No, I really made an effort to try to be distinct about it. I mean, history is history, so there are some things that you do have to go into if you're going to cover history of game shows, and it's a nonfiction work. But no, Game Show FAQ, the way I always put it is it's my 101 textbook if you're doing a game show history course. And that's the history of the past 100 years of game shows, going back to the 1920s with what we think was the first game show on the air, which was the Brooklyn Daily Eagle Current Events Quiz. And game shows were basically invented as a device to sell newspapers. The Brooklyn Daily Eagle was a newspaper that had current events bees, which it was the same format as a spelling bee, but it was trivia questions about recent news events. And they would always sell a special edition after every current events bee with all of the questions that were asked in the bee and all of the correct answers. And they always sold extra copies on the day that they sold the correct answers to the questions. Okay. So they decided to make a marketing tool out of radio and use the radio show to sell newspapers.
So that was, you answered the question I was going to ask. What was the first game show? I was thinking radio, and then I'm like, I don't even know. And then, but what's the first, I'll revise it, what's the first game show on radio that I guess people would remember? is it like $64,000 question?
I mean, it depends on how old your listeners are. I would say the first one.
Well, remember meaning it went into television, people remember it, even if it's not even airing currently. It's like,
I would say probably the earliest one that people today would have a sense of would be Truth or Consequences.
Okay.
That was the 1930s when that first came along, and it endured for over a decade and expanded into television and lasted off and on, it lasted for another 25 years on television. So I would say that's probably the even Ralph Edwards called it the granddaddy of all game shows or audience participation shows.
That popped in my mind when I was thinking about that. But, you know, I haven't read Martin Graham's book. I don't know if you had ever approached him or even attempted to do your own Truth or Consequences book. But his
no,
books, if
his
you
is definitive.
Yeah, his books are very thorough. It's like his would have kept your four volumes into one just because the way he is. Yeah, no. I've had him on the show before and he's great. So, but you know, it's just like, you know, so, you know, in doing that, do you try to pick game shows that just really haven't been covered for topics?
I try to pick things that I think people will be interested in and things that, frankly, I'm interested in because my reasoning is if I'm interested in it, then people like me, if they're out there, are going to be interested in it too. Bill Cullen was a guy who I thought deserved to have a book written about him. I thought certainly that there was an audience that was interested in Match Game because reruns of Match Game have been one of the most durable things on Game Show Network and on Buzzer since Buzzer launched. Yeah. So I knew that audience existed. So Gene was a natural choice. Dennis James, the first network game show host, one of the true pioneers and a name who should be remembered for all of the things that he did before anybody else did them. And that's just a remarkable story. So I wanted to get his story preserved. Yeah. And Alan Ludden, I mean, that was, people love Betty White. I don't know if you realize that about the internet, but I figured people would be interested in a book about Betty White's husband.
Yeah.
So that was the logic for all of these books. And then Monty Hall, a friend introduced me to Monty Hall's family at Monty's funeral, which was an unusual environment to meet somebody for the first time. But that led to me writing a revised and expanded version of the autobiography that Monty had written during his lifetime.
I see. Okay. Because I was wondering about that one because I thought he did do an autobiography, but most of your other ones, you know, Match Game and everything else, you know, haven't really been covered before, which makes me wonder, you know, like I said, do you try to choose subjects that haven't been covered? I know like Peter Marshall did a Hollywood Squares book and things like that. So you probably shied away
and
from another one, you know.
I certainly don't want to do that, and I don't want to cover any territory that I think has been definitively covered. A few people suggested that I write a book about, for anyone who knows this story, Michael Larson, the contestant on Press Your Luck, who won $110,000 by memorizing the sequence, the way that the lights flash around the board. Somebody suggested writing a book about that. And Game Show Network did an extraordinary documentary about 20 years ago. And it's not hard to find that documentary. And I cannot compete with the job that they did telling that story. Yeah. So I'm not interested in writing a book about that.
But you do have a whammy behind you, right?
I do. I have multiple whammies, yes.
Yeah, okay. I saw at least one of them there. Yeah.
It's the history of whammy marketing. For whatever reason, I've got a beanie whammy up here. I've got some stuffed whammies here. And then,
they made so many.
Well, the crazy thing is it took them the longest time to figure out that they could sell them. They made a Press Your Luck home game a few years ago and included a stuffed whammy in the box, which was the first time that really registered with them that a whammy was something people would buy. The other whammies in the market were not even on the market. That was the wrong way to say it, but they were just like freebies given to advertisers or business partners or things like that.
Oh, are those some of those that are behind you? Oh, okay. Got it. Okay. Now, I can ask you, well, I do want to ask you about Match Game a little bit, but, you know, I know the piece de resistance is, of course, the Gong Show book, which is why I said, I got to interview this guy. But unlike Stu, you know, anyway, I can do that because I've been on Stu's show, too. So there. Anyway, and Stu's been on this show, too. So anyway, Match Game growing up before Gong Show debuted was, along with Hollywood Squares, probably were my favorite game shows growing up in the early 70s. Were those yours as well? Or did you have other favorites that you might not have covered yet?
I got hooked on Match Game in the 1990s with Game Show Network reruns. I am a child of the 1980s and 1990s, Game was not my world.
Yeah.
But we got Game Show Network in the mid-1990s, and I was excited about the shows that I remembered. So when I first got Game Show Network, you know, I'm excited for the reruns of Wheel of Fortune with the shopping because I remember that. And I was excited for the reruns of The Price is Right with Bob Barker with black hair because I remember Bob having black hair for a while.
Right.
And I was looking for three models instead of for a super password. Those are the shows I was excited about seeing on Game Show Network. And I ended up on Match Game one night and got absolutely hooked on it. And I just thought it was funny. I thought it was engaging. I enjoyed the interplay with the celebrities and with Gene. Gene was such a different performer in the world of game show hosts that he stood out to me. So I became a real Match Game fanatic just from the reruns and remained so. And I just wanted to write a book about him in getting to know a little bit about who he was before he was the host of the Match Game. And it turned out he was a lot of things before he was the host of the Match Game. He was the original sidekick on The Tonight Show.
Yeah.
He basically invented morning drive time radio. He invented that format. Somebody called him the Howard Stern of the 1940s, which is a strange, that is a strange mental picture, but it's apt for Gene. That's the level of popularity that he had in the 1940s on radio.
Yeah. And if you count Match Game, he's kind of a little bit dirty sometimes, but I don't know if he, I don't know if he was dirty back in the 40s. He probably couldn't get away with that way back when. The Match Game 73 was my first exposure to the Match Game in any form. And I watched all those basically religiously throughout the 70s. And when they switched it out, I'm sure you covered it in the book, switched it out to, you know, the Hollywood Squares Match Game show. I was like, really? You know, and then I don't know if you cover later versions of the Match Game, but
Yeah, a little bit. I do deal with the Match Game Hollywood Squares Hour, which turned out to be quite a story. I think the Match Game Hollywood Squares Hour is the best failed idea ever.
Yeah, it was a great idea, but it's like
taking two celebrity game shows and mashing them together and making one gigantic game show out of them is a really neat outside the box idea that nobody had ever tried before, and it was a noble effort, but there were a lot of little things wrong with it, including but not limited to the fact that Mark Goodson did not like the idea of the celebrities giving joke answers to the questions on Hollywood Squares.
Right.
Which was a colossal mistake because that's Hollywood Squares. That's the identity of it. That's what people watch it for. Mark Goodson just could not accept that that's what people liked about the show. And he tried to do Hollywood Squares his way, and it didn't work.
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, I watched it anyway. I actually thought it was kind of interesting, you know, that they were clever enough to say, oh, Gene Rayburn can be on the Hollywood Squares box, and then John Bowser Bauman could be on the Match Game panel, you know, and it's like, so you don't have to get an additional host, you know, or hosts, you know. I thought that was kind of neat, but it kind of creaked along, and I was going, what happened to my Match Game? They ruined it. And even what happened to my Hollywood Squares? They ruined that too. And I'm like, in time since, I've realized everything has its day, and it probably would have ended at some point anyway. So, you know, for the Match Game book, did you interview any of the longtime panelists or anything like that, or even Gene himself?
Gene, I got a chance to talk to his daughter. She was a great interview, and very, very thoughtful and very, very honest about the way that she saw her father. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to talk to much of the panelists. Marsha Wallace passed away right as I was starting to work on the book. Yeah. And I was looking forward to talking to her, and I had a contact that was going to put us in touch, and then unfortunately we lost her. So that's a brain that I was never able to pick. And we had lost so many of the other stars. So not much in the way of the celebrity guests. I did get a chance to talk to Dick Gaudier, who was not by any means a regular on the show, but he had done it a few times. And he also had a chance to talk on another level about performing, because Gene was an aspiring / frustrated Broadway actor. Mm-hmm. And Dick Gaudier had some experience in that realm, and he could speak to that. And I also got a chance to talk to Peter Marshall, who was a friend of Gene's and Match Game a few times. Mm-hmm. So those were the folks from the celebrity realm that I talked to. Many of the people that I interviewed were the folks behind the scenes. Robert Sherman and Dick DiBartolo.
Oh, great. I was going to ask, did you get Dick DiBartolo? Because
Dick
even
was
me...
great to talk to.
Yeah.
Dick had a lot of great memories from that show.
I interviewed him for my Mad book, which is coming out any minute now. And But he still told me some Match Game stories. And of course I would ask because, you know, I love the show, you know, so I was asking him the difference between the old version and the new version and all that stuff. And, you know, he gave all, you probably know all the stories, you know, of how, yeah, you know, they took a chance on doing the clues a little differently and it got audience response on a show they were going to cancel. So it's like, you know,
they undid the cancellation. Yeah. They originally did the show very, very straight. It was questions like name a fact about an elephant or name a type of soup. And the show did fine. And as straightforward as that sounded, what Mark Goodson had in time was a game in the realm of Password.
Right.
It's this very sophisticated, celebrity-driven game. Mm-hmm. And instead, when the show started to wane, Dick DiBartolo's approach for salvaging it was to write zany questions.
Yeah.
Mary likes to put butter on John's blank. And yeah, that rescued the show. It saved the show from cancellation.
Mm-hmm.
And it became this legendary thing in the history of game shows.
It's really cool. Okay. Well, that brings us to the Gong Show, which by the late 70s, that was my new favorite game show. Did you interview any panelists from there or even possibly Chuck Barris?
No, Chuck we had lost by the time I started writing the book. Mm-hmm. I did get a chance to talk to Jamie Farr, and Jamie Farr has just an incredible memory and remembered things down to the specific tapings. He remembered specific days of that show. And he was thoughtful and he was very, very detailed in his thinking. He was breaking down elements of why our version of the show worked versus other versions of the show and going into detail about what the other versions of the show did because he watched and remembered the other versions of the show and was going, our version did this, here's why that went, here's why the other one went wrong. And
are you talking about the more recent one with Michael,
the Don Bluth
Mike
version
Myers
and the later versions after that? And it wasn't a crotchety old celebrity saying, oh, our version was better. He was very, very thoughtful and very, very insightful about why the way we did things works versus the way that other people tried to do it and didn't work.
Right.
And you could tell that he really understood, and it sounds weird to invoke this word when talking about the Gong Show, he understood the science of what made that show work. And it was a science, and there were a lot of little elements that came together and coalesced to make an amazing, amazing product.
Mm-hmm.
I
wish they'd have a show like that now. I mean, I know they brought back Gong Show a few years back with Mike Myers in costume and stuff like that. But really a show that, you know, and they come close. Like America's Got Talent, I thought kind of came close. But over time, it's gotten away from strange acts to more just singers. So it's like just another American Idol. And, you know, not very interesting.
Well, there's another element of that. America's Got Talent is close because they have had the zany acts like you were talking about.
Yeah.
But this is the tricky thing that people sort of overlook when they're saying, oh, I wish they'd bring the Gong Show back. That was such a great show. I wish they'd do that again. The tricky thing about the Gong Show is that Chuck was the secret sauce of the show.
That's true.
Chuck was the spirit of the show. Chuck was the flavor of the show. It was his sense of humor that was dictating it. It was his sensibility that was building everything. Everything that people remember fondly, everything that people liked about the Gong Show was Chuck Barris and his presence. And if Chuck Barris isn't there, and he no longer will be, you can do everything exactly the same. You can have the same kind of acts. You can have the same kind of celebrities on the panel. But if Chuck isn't there, then you don't have the Gong Show. It's going to be different. It won't be that thing.
That's true, because I even remember back in the day when they had Gary Owens, and I love Gary Owens as the host. It just didn't work as well. You know?
And that's the perfect example of it. It's Gary Owens, Chuck Barris was hosting the daytime version 5 days a week, and they had a concurrent version airing at night with Gary Owens as the host.
Yeah.
And you're right. It's when you see the way that Chuck Barris hosts the show, it feels correct. It feels like, oh, okay, this is what we're doing. This is the Gong Show. And Gary Owens was a talented performer in his own right, and he was a good master of ceremonies. But when you watch him on the Gong Show, this is wrong. This doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
I posted some video of Gary Owens hosting the Gong Show on my Facebook page. And somebody posted a comment that I can't do it justice verbatim, but the gist of it was watching Gary Owens host the Gong Show is like being a character in a time travel story where you've just returned to the present and everything is the way that you remember it, except one thing is wrong.
No, I remember
show with Gary Owens, and you're thinking to yourself, yeah. Well, it's that show I like.
Yeah.
But what is this? It's, yeah.
I mean, you know, it's just like, I hate to say, but because you did a book about him, but, you know, when I used to see Price is Right, and it wasn't Bob Barker, and it was, you know, the other guy, and it's like, no, you know, it's like, he's wrong, you know, and he did a good job, you know, it's just that, you know, he wasn't Bob Barker, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to put into words for somebody who's not really a game show viewer what the host brings to the table, but when you get a chance to see an example like that, where you see Bob Barker and Dennis James, and they're hosting the show in the same year, and it's the same set, and it's the same prizes, and the same games, but you see Bob hosting it and Dennis James hosting it. That's the example of, here's what a game show host does. Both of those guys brought an identity to the show.
Yeah.
And it's a little different depending on who's hosting it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And it's weird, because you know it because you wrote the book. What other game shows did Dennis James host around that same time, 60s, 70s, 80s, I guess?
Dennis hosted a slew of shows in the 1950s and 60s. He hosted the first, what's generally considered the first network show, in the sense that it aired on more than one station. It was called Cash and Carry, and that was in 1946. And then he went on to host a show called OK Mother, which was inspired by his own catchphrase as a sportscaster. Yeah. And then in the 1950s, he hosted shows like On Your Account, Turn to a Friend. He created a show called High Finance, which was his effort to get into the big money quiz craze. And then I would say beyond The Price is Right, probably his most successful game show was a thing he did for 4 years called PDQ.
Okay.
Which is, I think I remember that. The Hollywood Squares people. Yeah. It was, you would be shown a secret phrase. And the idea was you had all these letters in that phrase in front of you, but out of view of your partner. And you were trying to hold up as few letters as possible to make them recognize what the phrase was.
My memory of Dennis James, which is probably faulty, but it's like, oh, if the regular host is sick, let's get Dennis James in here. You know,
because that's actually how he won the Price is Right job. Bill Todman saw him guest hosting Let's Make a Deal.
He was on other things, so it wasn't totally brain dead on that.
Okay, and Bill Todman called the office and said, you know, that nighttime version of Price is Right we're planning, we should bring this guy in to host it.
Yeah.
So that's exactly how Dennis, and that's an element of television that was lost more and more as pre-taping and as 5 days a week became the norm. Was you lost that need for guest hosts,
right?
And it's so interesting to look back now and see all of these different talents that got opportunities for exposure and got a chance to build an identity and make a name for themselves by covering for people during their vacations. And that's something that television lost over time. It's kind of a shame.
Another one that comes to mind is the various dollar amounts of the pyramid. You know, you had Dick Clark most of the time, but occasionally you get Bill Cullen in there too. So it's like, you know, it was weird as a kid, you know, just, hey, where's the regular guy? But going back to the Gong Show, I'd say, that's, you could handle Dennis James doing Price is Right. You really couldn't handle Gary Owens because, you're right. It's like, something about Chuck Barris, you know, I don't know if it's because he's kind of loosey-goosey or he seemed kind of drunk or stoned or something. If that was him or that was just an act, it still kind of resonated. It's like, hey, he's hip, you know, and he's bringing all these weird acts out. He's as weird as those acts, you know, whereas Gary Owens was wearing a tux and all straight-laced and all,
And I mean,
laughing shtick, you know. It's like, you know.
Yeah, Chuck put himself on the level of the contestants. You zeroed in on something really, really well there. Mm-hmm. Chuck really connected himself to the contestants, and he allowed himself to get hit with pies or have the unknown comic insult him. He did things that let him get taken down a peg, because that way, you know, it's not just point at these people and laugh. It's Chuck is also allowing himself to be a victim of stuff, which was a very astute thing. The other thing that Chuck had going for him that gave him some chemistry, that was the word that Chuck used for the show. People may not realize how involved Chuck was with the show. It was members of his staff who did the first round of auditions. When you came in to try out for the Gong Show, it was people from his staff the first time. If they liked you enough and called you back for a second audition, it was Chuck conducting the second audition. And Chuck per the memories of a lot of the contestants that I talked to, Chuck would actually engage you in conversation while you were doing your audition, and he would get to know you. So you kind of struck up a rapport with Chuck while you were trying out for the show. And then when you got booked on the show, Chuck was the boss of the rehearsals. Chuck was the guy running the rehearsals. And there's footage of him, about 2 hours worth of footage of Chuck conducting rehearsals. And he's giving instructions to the acts about where to stand and how to walk and how to function on the stage. So by the time they're doing the show for real, and by the time they're on the stage, actually in front of America performing their act, they've gotten to know Chuck really, really well. And Chuck is almost a security blanket for some of these people, because he's been a constant for them throughout this entire process leading up to this completely alien experience for them of being on a national TV show.
Right.
So from that sense, it makes sense that Chuck felt he had better chemistry with the contestants, because he did. He got to know them, and they had that relationship by the time the show started.
Mm-hmm. Now, I assume, well, I shouldn't assume, I'll just ask, did you watch all the episodes that are available, and are they all available?
I watched as many as I could. There was a project some years back where I managed to get my hands on a lot of the master tapes of The Gong Show, a lot of dubs of the master tapes, and that spanned a couple hundred episodes. And between that and a private collector who just recorded The Gong Show religiously when it was in reruns on the USA Network in the 1980s. Oh, yeah. They did a total of about 650 episodes of The Gong Show from start to finish. I would say I watched a total of 450 researching the book. So I didn't get a chance to watch all of them, but I watched a very good representative sample of them, and watched them, most of them, more than once, which I'm sure will make me a good case study for some therapist someday.
So my question is, if you know this, and I have two people in mind, so who was the biggest celebrity to come out of The Gong Show that won? Or even if they didn't win, I don't know, but I know the two I'm thinking of did win.
I would say Mare Winningham, because Mare Winningham went on to be nominated for an Oscar, and she's really the only Gong Show contestant that can say that.
That didn't even occur to me. I mean, I'll tell you the ones I was thinking. I was thinking of Pee Wee Herman. And the other was the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo, which we got Danny Elfman. So, you know, but
those two. But I mean, it's really kind of take your pick, because you have Michael Winslow of Police Academy.
Oh, yeah.
Getting his national break, doing what he became known for on the Gong Show stage, doing all the sound effects. You had, even on the judges panel, you had people like David Letterman getting his early TV break by being a judge on the show. So there were a lot of up-and-comers, and the irony of it was Chuck had kind of given up on that idea very, very early on. Chuck, in its original form, what Chuck had in mind was a Stairway to the Stars, something like American Idol or Star Search, what those shows became, where it would be a proving ground for people to get their first exposure and become national celebrities. Mm-hmm. And the original auditions, the first round of auditions he conducted, were so dismal that he ended up flipping the premise on the advice of his friend Chris Beard. And it ended up being, okay, forget launching new talent. Forget looking for, you know, giving somebody their first chance of fame. This is just going to be for people to goof off on TV. Oh, okay. And just by doing that, it was a chance for people to get exposure anyway. So those up-and-coming aspiring stars were still showing up for it, and just doing very, very odd things in front of the camera. So it was exactly the opposite of what Chuck thought he was going to achieve.
Interesting. Because I always thought he planned it, but, you know, I have no proof. It's just my, you know, just knowing that he did, like, the Dating Game and the Newlywed Game, and they're pretty straight shows, even though you get the, you know, where's the weirdest place you make whoopee, you know, and things like that, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it seemed like he just wanted to break out and do something zany and goofy, but that wasn't the original plan for this.
Not really.
Interesting.
It's one of those things where a lot of great TV shows over the years have been a matter of very, very good luck. There's a lot of planning and a lot of thought goes into TV shows, but sometimes you just get extremely lucky, and The Gong Show was a matter of luck. Certain things just came together about that show.
Now, is The Gong always in the running? Is it like the the sketch ender or whatever, the performance ender, or was that a later edition?
It was, it was always going to be the gong. And that goes back to an old radio show, Major Bowes Original Amateur Hour.
Oh, yeah.
That goes back to the 1930s. And it's very strange that it was an innovative stamp that Chuck Barris put on an idea that was decades old.
Yeah.
And an idea that couldn't really be trademarked, as oddly specific as banging a gong for a bad act is, that's not something anyone can claim ownership over, because that goes back to the hook in vaudeville. And that goes back
to,
you know, there were radio shows that did their own knockoffs where it was like a car horn or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Now, was there any flack when he created the show? You mentioned, and it became Ted Mack's Amateur Hour later. Was there any flack from those people saying, stealing our show idea, you know?
I got a chance to talk to a gentleman who's kind of the gatekeeper for Ted Mack's Original Amateur Hour now. He has the rights to the show, and he sort of oversees the legacy of it.
Yeah.
And I did ask him about that, and he said no. And that was what he explained to me, was there's really nothing we could have filed suit over, because making a noise to disrupt an act that's going badly is such a generic idea that you can't own anything about that.
Yeah, and I guess doing a talent show in general. I guess.
America's Got Talent today. It's a buzzer. Yeah. That's no different from banging a gong. They just use a buzzer.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. Okay, because it always seems like nowadays everybody's so sue happy, they'd say, you're stealing our idea. Even if they lose, they would still do it out of principle, you know. I don't know. Is it true in your research on the Gong Show? Because I saw the Gong Show movie when it came out in the theater. Yes, it was me. And they that was kind of sort of a documentary, kind of.
In fact, it was interesting how that movie took shape. Originally, it was just going to be a straight up documentary.
Yeah.
And they did bring in cameras and they filmed auditions. They filmed some things going on behind the scenes. And the plan was to make it a documentary. And early on, Chuck just suddenly changed his mind and said, no, here's what we're going to do instead. We're going to make a movie about the Gong Show. And he wrote a screenplay, and they hired actors, and they did, they scouted for locations, and they actually made a scripted movie, but they used the documentary footage. So it's this very strange movie. It's a scripted fictional movie, but it incorporates actual things that happened around the offices and around the studio of Chuck Barris Productions.
Right.
And not a great movie. And Chuck even admitted that later. It was basically, it was him going through his midlife crisis in front of a camera. And it turned people off. And J.P. Morgan even pointed this out years later. And it's, rich people have feelings. Rich people are human beings. But, oh my God, who wants to listen to a rich person complain about how hard his life is? Nobody wants to, and especially for 90 minutes, nobody wants to listen to a wealthy person complaining about all of his difficulties.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a turnoff. The one great thing I can say about the movie is it has a killer song at the end. It ends with a show-stopping number called Don't Get Up. And the other thing about it was Chuck, during the course of production, decided he was going to shut down the Gong Show.
Right.
So this movie about how the Gong Show is going to go on forever, and Chuck is coming to terms with the fact that he's just going to keep doing the Gong Show and doing it and doing it. That actually ended up being the swan song for the Gong Show. Right. They never produced any other episodes after that movie came out.
Now, is it true what they showed in the movie? And I remember this episode, and the flack seemed to come out of the movie, but I was 12 or 13 or something when the show ended, and I knew what they were doing, but I didn't think about it being a show ending thing. Is the Popsicle Twins, you know. Now, was that, what's the story on that that you gathered from it? Because the movie tells one story, but was that really the reason the show went off the air?
No. And in fact, that was one of the things that I had to dig into, was finding out the reason that the Gong Show got canceled. Because the calendar of events didn't make sense for that. The Gong Show went off the air in July 1978. The Popsicle Twins appeared on the show in September 1977.
Yeah.
So that was, if it bothered NBC that much, then it was on the air for way too long after that.
Yeah.
Happened. So no,
I'm glad you clarified that, because it's like, I don't necessarily think I have a photographic memory, but at the same time, when it said that in the Gong Show movie, I was like, wait a minute, that didn't air at the end, you know, because I was watching the show. I wasn't tape recording it like your other friend there, but I was watching it pretty regularly, you know. Yeah. Like nightly and daily.
No, and they got a lot of flack for it. And there was definitely backlash for it. There were stations that did not air that episode because they got a warning about it from the affiliates on the East Coast who were horrified by it. And there was a lot of negative press about it. There were a lot of angry articles in the newspaper about this offensive segment of the Gong Show. So there was a lot of backlash about it.
I saw it because, you know, I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and San Francisco tended to not ban or cut things, you know, unless it was something that was instigated by powers that be on the East Coast. Well, like,
and I mean, the funny thing is they sold the reruns into syndication and, like I said, sold the reruns to USA Network.
Yeah.
And to my knowledge, did not bother cutting it out of the reruns.
No.
So it just kept airing over and over again for years after, to absolutely no major backlash from no major attention after the first time it happened.
Now, the one I don't remember, but it is in the Gong Show movie, but some claim it aired on regular TV, and maybe it did, I don't know, is when J.P. Morgan flashed the camera. Did that actually air, or did they put a black screen, or did they just not air it and people just
They had a graphic that they would use for not appropriate stuff, and it was one of those big sunburst overlays that they had on the set with the word "oops" across it. And
I probably saw that. Because I don't remember, because some people swear, oh, they just showed titty on television. It's like,
show it. Now, the uncensored thing,
I would have remembered that.
It is in the Gong Show movie because Chuck saved the master tape, basically. And the movie, they went ahead and used it, and it's not a recreation. They actually did show the footage. But the funny thing, talking to one of the people that I interviewed for the book, Vince Longo, who was Chuck Barris's staff photographer, and his job, as staff photographer was implied, he was in the studio for every taping, and he just photographed every taping nonstop. He was just constantly there taking pictures throughout every taping.
Mm.
And so we got to discussing that moment, and I said, do you have a photo I can use in my book? And he makes his face and he says, okay, I looked over, I saw JP unbuttoning her shirt, and I thought to myself, oh my God, I don't think she's wearing a bra underneath. I know what she's about to do. And I crouched down and I got in position and I got ready to take a shot. And then the cameraman operating the big NBC No. 3 camera takes a step backwards to get a shot of something else that's going on. And his ass is in the way of the shot. So I've got this photo of, you see like JP Morgan's arm flying out, but all you see is just this cameraman's ass in the way. So you don't see anything.
Funny. Wow. Trying to think of other memories. Well, the Gong Show movie itself, it was a big flop. I did see it because I was a Gong Show fan, and you know, I went to see it, and the theater was kind of half full, I suppose. And you know, there's mild laughter and stuff throughout the whole thing. So I mean, people kind of stuck with it. There's nobody holding their nose and walking out on it. But then it wasn't available on home video until like maybe like 5-6 years ago or something like that. Is that correct?
It was a long time. It was a well-kept secret. And I can remember as a kid, the local NBC station just suddenly aired it on a weekday afternoon one day.
Yeah.
Like I don't know if a ball game got rained out or something, because they usually didn't air movies on a weekday afternoon on that station. But for some reason, on a lark, they aired the Gong Show movie one day. Uh-huh. So that was my first exposure to it. And it's one of those, when you watch something as a kid, and this is one of those things that the younger generation doesn't understand, is you would see something on TV and have no means to look it up or see what it was or learn any information about it. You would see things on TV and they would just disappear.
Right.
And then you wouldn't see it again. They wouldn't announce that it was going to air some other time. So for the longest time, the Gong Show movie was this thing that I had seen when I was 6. And I would just look back and I'd be like, did I imagine that? Did they make a movie out of the Gong Show?
Yeah.
So for the longest time, I was under the impression that that was something that my brain had just kind of invented. And then it turned out, oh my God, I found it, unfortunately, was real. Yeah, I found it in Leonard Maltin's movie guide, and I almost fell out of my chair because I was like, oh, that movie actually happened.
Yeah. Now, but do you know why it was held from release all those years? I mean, I know it's a flop, but stupider movies bigger flops have come out on home video over the years, so it couldn't be that. You know?
I don't know if there was any particular reason. I certainly didn't find anything in my research. I just think there was no enthusiasm for it, or there was no enthusiasm for it.
I didn't know if Chuck himself was holding it back, or if it was like, any of the people in the film, would have made issue about it. Another question I have about the show is, it was my first exposure to a lot of different people. I knew Jamie Farr because he was on MASH, but I had never even heard of Rex Reed. Who is this guy? And I found out he's a movie reviewer, ostensibly. And then J.P. Morgan herself, I didn't even know who she was. I found out, she was a singer at some point. But, it took years to figure all this stuff out because, as you said, there wasn't ready research on it. So these people were on my TV gonging these various acts, and they kept acting like they're big, important people. And I was like, who are they? So were these personal friends of Chuck, or how did people get on the show as a judge?
What's funny is you see an evolution happen very, very early in the run of that show. For the first few weeks that it's on the air, it's your typical game show celebrity Rolodex.
Mm-hmm.
So you would see people like Avery Schreiber, and you would see people like Joyce Bulifant, and see people like Fannie Flagg.
Right.
And you would see them on the show once, and then you would never see them on the show again.
Right.
Because really, I think what happened was a lot of celebrities who said, yes, I'm willing to do game shows, had experience with the Gong Show or had a chance to watch it and went, whoa, I want nothing to do with this. I'm afraid of this show. I don't know what it's going to do.
I would have signed up immediately.
Yeah. So the people like Jamie Farr and Rex Reed who were willing to do the show and do it a second time became very, very prized and very, very important to Chuck Barris. And that's why if you look at the Gong Show compared to other celebrity panel shows of that era, it's a much narrower rotation of celebrities on that show. The reason you saw the same people over and over again was because a lot of celebrities wanted nothing to do with that show. They were so scared of guilt by association.
And it's funny that it did kind of narrow down to Jamie Farr, Rex Reed, and J.P. Morgan for the most part. I mean, they had different celebrities over time, but I never understood why. But it didn't matter to me. I mean, as long as they didn't interfere. I mean, I always liked it on the show when one wanted to gong and the others were trying to prevent them from gonging the thing or something like that. So
standing in front of it.
So they were making it entertaining even for that. And they do it a little bit on America's Got Talent, too. They just don't buzz that person, whatever. But, then they finally all gong at the same time or whatever. Anyway. What other questions do I have about it? I don't remember. It seems like this pretty much was it for Chuck Barris at this point. He had a book and a movie that came out later. It was like about all his weird espionage stuff and everything. But as far as game shows, he's pretty much done after this.
Chuck pulled the show in 19 along with everything else he was doing. Chuck shut down the company the summer of 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of regrouped and reorganized, and one of the curious things he did was he tried to reinvent the Gong Show and go back to that original conception of the Stairway to the Stars. He produced a pilot called Million Dollar Talent Search, which was the Gong Show, except it was going to be serious. And it was going to be for a big prize. The grand prize was the winner at the end of the season was guaranteed enough nightclub bookings that the total income would be $1 million. Hence $1 million talent search.
Wow.
And a pilot was shot, but they couldn't get it on the air. Wow. And then Chuck dabbled a lot in the 1980s. There was a period where he was trying to buy up a lot of low-powered TV stations. And the idea was he was trying to string together enough TV stations that he was going to start a network called Channel America. And that didn't get off the ground. He began selling the reruns of his old shows. That did pretty well for him. He made a lot of money off the reruns. And there were reboots. They did the new Newlywed Game, the new Dating Game, and there was even a revival of the Gong Show that Chuck didn't host or didn't participate in at all. But Chuck basically just got out of television altogether during the 1980s. after these fits and starts of, okay, I shut down my company, now I'm going to start over again. I'm not going to do this. Well, maybe I'm going to do this. And just finally, just 1987, he sold the company and got out altogether. And he moved away to a little rural area of France. And I don't want to say went into hiding. He wasn't, his neighbors certainly knew who he was. That's one of the miracles of Facebook and social media. I actually got a chance to connect with one of his neighbors in France because it turned out we had a mutual friend.
Oh, wow.
So I ended up having this conversation with a woman who, like Chuck, she was an American expatriate who was just living in this rural area of France at that time and lived up the street from Chuck. So she knew him pretty well. And she said, you know, Chuck, when Chuck got out of television, he was done with it. He never talked about wanting to go back in. And he said, we never even had a conversation about TV. TV didn't interest him. What he talked about was books. And Chuck, there was a part of Chuck that really wanted to be the great American author. And he wrote a lot of books later in life, novels and a couple of memoirs. And never got a chance to become a big name in that field, like I think he was hoping he would.
Yeah.
But Chuck was one of those rare people that you see in show business who had a lot of success, but then walked away and stayed away. He really, he didn't attempt a comeback. Once he said, I'm done with TV, he actually meant it and never came back with a new idea or anything like that.
Interesting. Yeah. I assume that he did the similar thing with the music industry because he wrote Palisades Park. And I assume he tried this other song.
I mean, that was kind of an accident. It was a thing where he just happened to have the idea for a song. I don't think he was ever looking to become, although he certainly did. He kept recording and writing tunes. Yeah. I think it just worked out that way. I don't think he had it in his head that he was going to become a big name in the music industry, but it was just one of those things where the opportunity presented itself.
So that was more of a stepping stone. So he didn't really walk away from it. He just wanted ventured more into television.
It was just something he did, and it happened to make him some money.
That's cool. Okay. the other thing, and I don't know how this fits in, but I'll just tell you, so years ago, when the show was still on the air, did the NBC studio tour in Burbank, and that's where I first saw the Hollywood Squares, and I was like, oh my God, these things are tiny, because everything looks bigger on TV. Yeah. You know, and it's like there's like no headroom. So if you're like a real tall celebrity, you're not going to fit, you know. But the other thing was cleaning up during this time was the performer who played Gene the Dancing Machine. And I didn't know he was actually like a, you know, sweep up guy and all sorts of utility things for NBC. You know?
Gene had been the janitor at John Muir High School, which was a high school here in Southern California for aspiring performers.
Yeah.
And I had a chance to talk to one of the students there who remembered Gene. And he said, everyone there kind of knew Gene the janitor because when Gene didn't have anything else to do, he would just wander into the back of the classroom and he'd stand there and listen to the professor's lectures. And so everyone was just aware of Gene the janitor. And in the early 1970s, there was an issue with the unions. There was a complaint being made that there was no diversity in the stagehands unions. And so there was a big diversity push and a big call for getting non-white union members. And a lot of the John Muir graduates who remembered Gene the janitor said, let's get Gene the janitor and get him into the union. Because everybody who went to that high school remembered him. So Gene was one of the first black stagehands and may have been the first black stagehand who joined that union. And he was working at NBC. And what happened was Milton DeLugge and the band were playing a song one day during a break. And Chuck glanced over and he saw Gene holding his push broom and kind of dancing with his push broom. And that just charmed Chuck to no end. And Chuck thought, I want to put this guy on TV.
Okay.
And so that began the legacy of Gene the Dancing Machine. And Gene had basically 3 or 4 years of fame from that. But then the postscript to this was after the Gong Show ran its course, Johnny Carson pretty much adopted him. And you began seeing Gene the Dancing Machine on The Tonight Show. Not dancing, but they would usually, like, he would just be a featured player in sketches or whatever.
Right, right. But and that's another thing I saw, and I think I said on one of my other podcasts for the that, you know, I saw the Tonight Show set, and it's like, you know, like I said, everything looks larger on TV, but on my, you know, in person, it was like, okay, here's where Johnny sits. There's the curtain and there's the band. It's like, it's all really tiny. And it's yeah. like, you know, and that's when I saw Gene sweeping up. So I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, and that was a strange, interesting double life. And it's a little akin to seeing Biff Henderson on Letterman's show for years and years.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody gave me a master tape of Letterman, and you could hear stagehand discussion during the breaks, and you can hear Biff like laying out orders and discussing, and it's just so crazy to listen to that and realize, wow, Biff had an actual job. Like,
yeah,
he
was actually doing things.
He was a real stagehand.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with Gene, to realize that this guy was a major network TV star while also having the responsibilities of a crew member.
Yeah.
It's just a very weird double life that Chuck gave
him. Because I thought, until I saw him sweeping up, I thought, you know, he's just a paid actor, kind of like, Murray Langston, the known comic, you know, it's like kind of like that, you know. And that's another question about the show is, so he had things like Gene, he had the unknown comic come out. Was that always in the planning of the show to have acts that weren't like official acts just to pad it out, or did that
not
just
from the
evolve?
Very beginning? A problem presented itself early on that nobody had really thought of, which is the acts had a 90-second time limit. Whatever you did, it had to be 90 seconds. So most singers had to chop their songs down to a 90-second. But that was the time limit for the Gong Show. Your act had to be 90 seconds. And the judges had to wait for 45 seconds until they could gong you. There was a stagehand giving them signals for when they had to wait and when they were allowed to bang the gong.
Mm-hmm.
So if you bang the gong, that's 45 extra seconds that the show has now. If you have three acts that get gonged, that's now over 2 minutes of extra time that the show has now. So the gong, just the very nature of the Gong Show messed up the timing. You couldn't plan the proper amount of time for the Gong Show, because if that gong got banged, it would create these holes in the show that you couldn't account for.
I never thought about that's funny.
Yeah, and so there immediately became this pressing need for stuff that would fill time.
Yeah.
And they devised a series of acts called curtain closers, and Murray Langston originally auditioned to be a contestant. He wanted to be a contestant on the show, but they were looking for running jokes that they could do on the show that would fill some time. And they asked Murray Langston, can you keep coming back and doing this, and we'll pay you for every appearance? And, okay, you're paying me for every appearance. Yes, I'll come back and do it every time. But that was the function that Murray Langston was filling. That was the function that Gene the Dancing Machine was filling. Chuck had multiple employees who had recurring characters on the show. A lot of the running gags that you saw were not actors. They were staff members who had actual jobs, but they would change into costumes on a moment's notice to do whatever Chuck needed them to do to kill some time for 2 minutes.
See, I didn't think that was absolutely necessary, because it's figured, well, if somebody got gone, there's 10 other acts in the wings all ready to go, so it doesn't matter. You wouldn't run out, you know, even, you know, it's like if there's 30 acts and they all got gonged in the first whatever seconds and you need 30 more acts, you could bring them all in. But I guess there is a time and place where it would all run out and you need some buffers, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that makes sense. I never really thought about it that way, but, you know, whatever.
And Chuck also had acts called ringers. Once it became clear that the weird acts were going to be the selling point, the identity of this show, Chuck became very, very scared that they would run out of weird acts. Like, people would stop auditioning with weird acts. So Chuck began encouraging his staff to come up with strange things to do on the Gong Show. And just kind of the trick was, Chuck would introduce them and they would perform the act and then walk off stage without being judged. And the idea was, maybe the home viewers would notice and maybe they wouldn't notice that this act just came on and performed and the judges didn't give them any kind of score, or they did a terrible performance and didn't get gonged or whatever. The whole point of the ringer acts was to do something weird in the hopes that like would attract like, that a viewer would see it at home and come up with a weird new act to do on the Gong Show and audition for it.
Yeah.
And that way they wouldn't run out of those kinds of acts.
Yeah. I guess that I, you know, didn't really think about it because, yeah, like, you know, when Gene was on there, I mean, they threw a bunch of crap at him, but they didn't ever gong him, you know, I figured that's just part of the show. So you didn't have to gong everybody. And he might have, if memory serves, he might have introduced those acts differently. I know on Gene, it wasn't like he says, okay, we got a new guy here that's going to be hit, you know, whatever. It was like the music started and you knew.
The music would start,
and then he'd go, yes, all right, you know, and all that stuff, whatever he used to do. You know, I'm doing this all from memory. So it's like, you know, that's how ingrained this crap is in my head. No wonder Stu didn't want to do this, you know. Anyway. Well, I guess on the Gong Show book, Gong this book, what was the most interesting thing you discovered in doing the book, or have you already revealed that?
The most interesting thing I discovered, I got a chance to talk to the executive who made the call to cancel the show. And I got a chance to hear it directly from his mouth why the show was canceled. And that was a surprising thing, because even Chuck's own employees had heard, well, it was because of the Popsicle Twins. And again, that didn't make sense to me, but even Chuck's own staff had said that's what they had heard. And so it was interesting to finally get an answer to that, which you can find in the book.
Okay.
But
darn, I have to read it now.
Yeah.
No, I do plan to do
so it. That was a big surprise. His name is Michael Brockman, and he's an amazing name in the history of daytime TV. We had a chance to interview him for the National Archives of Game Show History Project that I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And it's just extraordinary the work that this guy did at all three networks during the 70s and the 80s. Getting to know him and getting to find out that reason for the show's cancellation, that was the big surprise. The other surprise was getting a chance to talk to Chuck's employees and finding this softer side of Chuck and finding what kind of boss he was. Chuck's employees spoke in reverent terms of him. And it's not a case of he was the big, powerful boss and we're intimidated by him, and so we still have to sing his praises after all these years. Chuck's employees are very protective of him.
Yeah.
And I got that vibe right away. And I wanted to assure them right away that I'm writing this book because I'm a fan of the show and I appreciate it and I admire the work that he did.
Yeah.
But I just remember at all times, it was very, very clear that these people cared about Chuck and worried about what other people said about him, because they saw this deeply sensitive, deeply troubled guy who wanted to do right by everybody and wanted to create a good show and just really wanted people to appreciate him. Mm-hmm. And they were, that really stuck with me, was the way his employees felt about him and the way that even now after his death, they all kind of circle around him spiritually and just want to make sure that he's cared for.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's kind of a good thing to hear, because sometimes you hear years later, oh, Chuck Barris, he was an asshole. Hated working for him. But, you know, instead they're coming off as protective and, you know, keeping the memory alive in a good way and everything, which is good. I'm sure he had his moments like everyone else, but, you know, it's like it's refreshing to hear that he seems like he would have been a likable guy off camera as much as on camera, because, you know, when those shows aired originally, that was the talk of the school and everybody be imitating him. They'd pull a hat on their head and do the clapping and all that stuff. And so, you know, it was popular stuff. So,
and the third big surprise, I'll simply say, and again, this goes back to, I'm going to be coy and just say by the book, but discussing drug culture at Chuck Barris Productions was the other big surprise. And we go into detail about that, and please read that section.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, before we go, and you've done a very good coverage of Gong this book. what other projects are you considering for a game show book, or are you considering any non-game show books?
A few things in the pipeline that I don't want to discuss publicly, because there's a roadblock standing in the way of two ideas that I have right now, and We'll see if those can be resolved, but I don't want to hype any projects for now. For the moment, a lot of my spare energy is going into the National Archives of Game Show History at the Strong National Museum of Play, and we're still trying to get that off the ground and hope to have some exciting news in the next few years about that. So that's what I have ahead of me.
Okay. And I know it's not going to be Wheel of Fortune, because Wesley Hyatt's working on a Wheel of Fortune.
Wesley Hyatt is working on what I think will be a very good book about that
show. Is fine. Yeah. And, you know, I got his Betty White book to go along with The Password. Yeah. And what's the other book he did? Oh, I love his Carol Burnett book. And, you know, anyway. So anyway, it was a pleasure having you on the show. I guess promote bong this book this time. No, you said the drug stuff, now it's bong this book. Okay, promote that one or any other books you think people should be interested in alongside it, where they can find it, and how they can contact you if they have any game show questions.
All of my books are available at Amazon, barnesandnoble.com, and at the publisher, bearmanormedia.com, bearmanormedia.com. Those are the three best resources for buying my books. And I'm also just a click away at Facebook. So if you have any questions, be sure to reach out to me. I'm easy to find. I'm the only Adam Neidiff on earth.
And in the next couple months, this will probably be up in April, but in the next couple months, are you going to do any appearances or signings or anything to do with game shows that people?
I hope so, but nothing lined up yet.
Okay. Fair enough. Okay. But when you have your next book, whatever that may be, you know, I'd love to have you back on the show. We can talk again about game shows and things like that. And it's a pleasure having you on the show, Adam.
It was a pleasure being here.
All right. Well, that wraps it up for another episode of Fun Ideas Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Arnold, and we will see you next time.
Thank you for listening, and thank you, Adam Neidiff, for being my special guest. Remember, you can always watch the video version of this episode on YouTube. Episode number 259 will be coming soon. If you would like to comment and or be a guest on this podcast, please drop me a line at funideas.mark@gmail.com. Become a free subscriber or a paying Patreon at Mark Arnold Fun Ideas Productions. If everyone listening just contributed $1 a month, it would be a tremendous help in continuing the production of my books and this podcast. The opening and closing music for this podcast is provided by Elmo and Almo. This has been the Fun Ideas Podcast. This has been Mark Arnold speaking. This episode is copyright 2024 Fun Ideas Productions. Thank you and good night.